chutzpah, glitch, klutz, schlep, kibitz, tchotchke, they're some of the many Yiddish words that have entered into the everyday American lexicon. So during this Jewish holiday season, we thought that we'd find out all about the Yiddish language for this week's Please Explain. And joining us are Jonathan Brent, Executive Director at Ivo Institute for Jewish Research, and Eddie Portnoy, Academic Advisor at Ivo. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan, when did the Yiddish language originate and where?
Well, as far as I know, it's still a matter of some debate, as are most things about Yiddish, but... I think there's general agreement that it originated around the 10th century, maybe a little earlier. It's not clear whether it originated in the Ruhr Valley or elsewhere, but I think there is a certain amount of consensus that it certainly originated in German-speaking lands.
Because most of the words are related to German?
Well, a lot of the vocabulary is, but I think it's mainly the grammar that relates it most to Germanic languages. A lot of vocabulary comes from Slavic. A lot of vocabulary comes from Hebrew. And then there's a smattering of other languages, such as French and Swedish, Lithuanian, so forth.
Have there been American editions?
Absolutely. And the... newest editions are the product of the use of Yiddish by the Hasidim in the United States, who have Americanized the language considerably.
Eddie, has it always been a language spoken only by Jews?
No, actually it hasn't. I would say for the most part the speakers are Jews, but anyone who interacted with the Jews, with the Yiddish-speaking Jews on a significant basis... invariably learned Yiddish, whether it was the Struzan, the superintendents of the buildings the Jews lived in Poland or in Warsaw, who spoke Yiddish. They were never able to write it, read and write it, but in order to interact with the Jewish community, they did speak it.
Now, they weren't able to read and write it because it's written with Hebrew letters.
Yes, that's correct.
Was it an alternative to Hebrew?
It was the vernacular in the same sense that, let's say, Latin was the sort of holy language of Christianity or Catholicism. Hebrew was the holy tongue, Loshon Kodesh, and it had sort of... an element of prestige to it, whereas Yiddish was really the everyday language of the Jews.
So, Jonathan, since it's written with the Hebrew alphabet, can anyone who can read Hebrew also read Yiddish?
Well, I think with a little effort, yes. There are some variations. There are some differences. There are no vowels, for instance, vowels under the letters. All of the vowels are incorporated into Yiddish through different letters.
The way they are in Roman-based languages, the way English uses vowels.
Right, it's a phonetic language. Yeah. It's written phonetically, rather.
Completely.
It's called the language of the Ashkenaz. For those who don't know, can you explain the difference between Ashkenazi Jews and how they're distinctive from others, like the Sephardim?
Well, Ashkenazi Jewry has... its own folk ways, its own language, which is Yiddish, its own food. Sephardic Jewry, for example, this is the Jewry of Spain and its diasporas. Ashkenazi Jewry is really the Jewry of Central and Eastern Europe and its diasporas.
Now, the Sephardic Jews have their own language, Ladino. Did it develop around the same time as Yiddish, Jonathan?
I believe it developed a little bit earlier, but I don't know. Maybe Eddie knows more.
Did the two languages develop for similar reasons?
Well, they developed in similar ways. Jews tended to live separately in separate communities, and as a result, they developed distinctive languages. Even though, you know, the basis of both Ladino and Yiddish are respectively Spanish and German, they have their own variants. The Jews have their own specifically Jewish versions of these language.
There's languages. Also a lot of Hebrew in both of these languages.
Yeah.
For example, a word like goyim, it means nations in Hebrew, doesn't it?
Right. And really, it's come to mean Gentiles.
Yeah, or the man. A way of saying the man?
In a way.
Was there much literature written in Yiddish in the early days?
Well, initially, the Yiddish literature, they're like English literature, we have an old Yiddish, like there's old English. For example, the first page with written Yiddish on it was discovered to be dated at from 1272. And it's just really a little note in a prayer book. But in subsequent centuries, we have a number of stories and booklets. There's the Shmuel Buch and the Melochim Buch, and these are books that are with Yiddish stories based on the biblical books of Samuel and Kings, but because they were produced in the medieval period, they have included kind of chivalrous knights' tales in them.
Is that when the Yiddish language flourished most, or did that come later?
No, that's really just the beginnings of it. Subsequent to that, in the beginning of the 16th century, Yiddish literature really got its first master, a man by the name of Elia Bocher, or as he's known in other languages, Elijah Levitas. And he translated he created a Yiddish adaptation of a medieval knight's tale called Bovo d'Antona. And in Yiddish, it became the Bove Buch. And it is a story written in rhyme. Really a very convoluted story about a boy who's born to a king whose mother has the king killed, and he gets kidnapped, and he gets sent to become a stable boy in some other king's kingdom. He falls in love with the princess, and it becomes this whole convoluted story, and it's a very, you know, sort of typical medieval knight's tale that was really very popular in most languages in Europe, and this is the Yiddish version of it. This became the Yiddish language's first bestseller. I just want to add one quick thing, and it became known as the Bove Meise. This term Bove Meise became bastardized to Bobe Meise, a grandmother's tale. And so that a Bobe Meise is a common term for, you know, an outlandish tale, which this was exactly.
My guests are Eddie Portnoy, academic advisor at YIVO Institute for Jewish Research, and Jonathan Brent, who is YIVO's executive director. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're talking about Yiddish on today's Please Explain. We invite your calls, 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Jonathan, in 1908, Yiddish was named the official language of the Jewish people. Who came up with that? Who named it that?
Well, that was the Chernovitz Conference where that occurred, and there were many of the leading Yiddish writers of the time who attended it, and it was like the great Jewish think tank, and they decided that Yiddish should be so designated because by that point the Yiddish language had already acquired a certain political value in terms of the self-understanding of the Jewish people of Eastern Europe and Russia. Many writers had been by this point writing about the importance of Yiddish in building the what they thought of as the Jewish nation in the diaspora.
So this was this comes along at around the same time that Zionism is starting to take hold.
Yes,
but then when Israel is created, Yiddish is not made the official language. Rather, Hebrew and Arabic are.
Correct.
Were there efforts to make Yiddish the official language of Israel?
No, I doubt that there were any real efforts. Yiddish was thought of. There was really a lot of intense conflict between the Yiddishists in Eastern Europe and the Zionists. Not all of the Zionists were opposed to Yiddish, but most of the Yiddishists were reluctant to yield their sense of nationhood to building of the state of Israel and Palestine before the war. In any case, I think the thinking of people like David Ben-Gurion and others was that Yiddish represented the old world. It represented, to a large extent, a world that had been destroyed, a world that was remembered as deficient in a variety of different ways, not least of which in terms of enabling Jews to realize their potential to be a free, autonomous, strong people in the modern period.
But, Eddie, on the other hand, Yiddish was a modern language, and Hebrew was an ancient language that had to be totally restructured to function in the modern world. But I guess that was part of the idea, that we want to see a total change here.
Right, and actually the negative attitude of Zionists toward Yiddish occurs much earlier on than the advent of the State of Israel. Early Zionists were opposed to Yiddish because they felt it was the language of the ghetto. It was the language of the defeated Jew, and that they were attempting to build a new Jew. And that new Jew would not speak this old, antiquated language.
A listener writes in, or called in, to say that Yiddish was her first language. She learned it here in the United States from her European parents. But when she speaks to Yiddish scholars, they always correct her. And she feels there isn't and shouldn't be an official Yiddish language because it incorporates so many different regional cultures or regional values.
That's true. Although at some level you do have to have standardization. You can't, you know, let everything run wild with a language. Although, you know, I tend not to correct people when I speak to them.
If I could jump in for a second, I think that this desire to standardize the language was part of the larger effort to create a national identity that could have a center to it. One of the obvious facts about the Jewish world of Eastern Europe was that it was transnational and decentered. And one of the ambitions of those who were writing about the creation of a Jewish nationhood out of the Jewish people was that it have a somewhat, not entirely, but somewhat unified, or codified at least, premises, and the language was one of them.
But I would assume
where Evo came from, by the way.
In what way?
Well, the Evo Institute was the first academy of the Jewish people in Eastern Europe. And part of its ambition was precisely to standardize the language.
Well, I would assume that because Yiddish was spoken all throughout Eastern Europe, that there were Polish words incorporated into Polish Yiddish, there were Russian words incorporated into Russian Yiddish. Different parts of Germany probably had different words. And then, of course, that even happens in this country, where words like Yenta are invented in the United States. They don't have European origins. But wouldn't that suggest that Yiddish is kind of like English and just is very welcoming to any word that's useful?
Right. It's a fusion language. It's, you know, linguistically it's very flexible. It absorbs components of other languages very easily. So as you said, in different countries where Jews emigrated to, you have words that you know from those languages. So you have, you know, in America you have English and Yiddish, in Argentina you have Spanish and Yiddish, Russia Russian, all along the board.
And do either of you know the story of how Yenta came into the language?
I do.
That's Yenta Bolaventa?
It's Yenta Telebenda.
Telebenda.
Yenta Telebenda was a column written in the Jewish Daily Forward by a representative of B. Kovner, and it was about a almost like a Lucille Ball character, sort of a goofy, garrulous woman named Yenta Telebenda, and that the name Yenta began being used in Yiddish for just that type of woman.
A gossip. Does that move to Europe as well? Would people in Europe know what the word Yenta means?
They might be able to infer what you mean. Another name that's also used for that is a Yachne. But ironically, the name Yenta comes from the French gentil, which means pleasant or nice.
Or Gentile.
Right, also.
My guests are Eddie Portnoy, who's the academic advisor at YIVO Institute for Jewish Research, Jonathan Brent, executive director at YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. We're talking about Yiddish on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopatin. We'll come back with some of those calls after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with today's look at the language Yiddish on Please Explain. Jonathan Brent, executive director of YIVO Institute for Jewish Research, is with us, and Eddie Portnoy, academic advisor at YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's go to a caller, Sonia from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call, because I'm very passionate about what you're talking about, since Yiddish was not only my first language, but I was part of a very, very large a movement across the United States and South America to teach Yiddish as a secular language. We went after school 5 days a week. I even went to Yiddish high school on the weekends. It is a standardized language. There is a right and wrong way to say it. There is a spelling. There is a huge literature, so that the woman who said you can't correct me because people just talk, it's not so. It's as real a language as English is.
So we're talking about an oral tradition and a written tradition.
Yes.
And standard people can speak in slang, in English slang, quite differently than they may want to write if they were writing a book or an article.
Right.
We have a listener, Harvey from Nyack, along these lines, who asked, is Yiddish being taught formally anywhere? He remembers hearing his parents and grandparents speaking it and worries that that the language is dying out.
It's most certainly being taught. It's being taught in universities, in colleges. It's being taught at the YIVO Institute. It's taught at the National Jewish Book Center in Amherst. And it's being taught in Poland and in Lithuania and in Germany and in Russia now. So there is a real revival, I believe, of teaching of Yiddish around the world. For our summer program at the YIVO Institute, we have students coming from Ukraine and from Moscow and from Germany and Lithuania. We even had some from Africa.
A listener, Brian from Queens, left this comment on our show page. People often describe Yiddish as a dying or even as a dead language, but I find myself listening in on Yiddish conversations all the time on the New York City streets and subways. It's just that it's almost always being spoken by ultra-Orthodox Jews. The gulf between these communities and secular Yiddishists in academia is longstanding, and he would love to hear your takes on the ways that scholars and other enthusiasts can bridge the gap.
The gap between academic secular Yiddish and the ultra-Orthodox populations that speak Yiddish has really decreased in the last few years. There have been a number of students and scholars who are interested in these communities and want to get involved in studying them. One group, for example, Jugendruf, which is Youth for Yiddish, They recently put out their journal, and for the first time, I think ever, they have stories written by Hasidim. Also, one of Yugen's Roof's projects, Yiddish Farm, which is a entirely Yiddish-speaking farm, which also has Yiddish programs in, I think it's Goshen, New York, which is fairly close to some of the ultra-Orthodox communities, also interact with these communities. And so there is more and more of a connection between them.
And Goshen, of course, has a biblical source, so maybe that's appropriate. Shia from Borough Park, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Yiddish speaker. My first language is Yiddish, and I teach my kids also the first language to speak Yiddish. I would like to understand that Yehovah has a standardization for Yiddish coming from Lithuania, Vilna. And from the question is, today most of the majority of Yiddish speakers are Hasidic people, and they have the dialect and accent and writing from Romanian and Hungarian. The question is if Yehovah is planning something to accommodate to standardize the Hasidic way of speaking Yiddish?
That's an excellent question, and at this point we do not have any plans to further the standardization of the Yiddish language. But it's certainly something that is worth considering, and it's worth continued dialogue on this subject.
Now, I mentioned earlier that a lot of Yiddish words have entered into the general American lexicon, chutzpah, glitch. People would be surprised that glitch is a Yiddish word. Klutz, schlep, kibitz, chachka, tuchus. A listener writes that she, Sherry, on Twitter, says she tried to tell a Jewish lady that she's a shiksa. Instead, she told her that she's a shikshka, which evidently means that she's a drunk.
A shikerta.
So, but why do you think that certain words, and including many words we can't say the English translations of, are have entered into the English language? Is it just that there's no English no English version of them?
Well, sometimes a foreign version is better than the English version, and
well, like fetch is so much better than a complainer,
right? It's got that sort of onomatopoeic quality. It depends who's writing and who's working with it. Yiddish has influenced New Yorkese far more than it's influenced people in Boise, Idaho.
Although even people in Boise, Idaho have probably seen the word chutzpah in print.
More than likely.
Although
well,
they probably
Michelle
don't.
Bachman.
Right. They may read it in print and say chutzpah.
Yeah, but right. But I pronounce her name Michelle Bachman, so it works both ways.
I think if I could add something to this a little bit, I think that first of all, I had a very good friend who was a great linguist at Yale University, who insisted that Yiddish was what he called an emotive language. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was his theory. However, I do think that the allure of Yiddish has to do with Yiddish culture as much as with the language itself. And it has something to do with the fact that the East European Jews, when they came over in great numbers at the beginning of the 20th century, were both marginal but central at the same time, which is an odd position to be in as an outsider group. They were marginal because they came from Eastern Europe, but the culture that they brought with them bore in it so much that was already implanted and central in West European culture that the language that they spoke became kind of a fascination. And so I think there's a kind of a romance about this that is actually unique to the Yiddish language.
There was a Molly Picon show many years ago, obviously, which was based on the fact that Yiddish often has these phrases that don't translate well, like she would say, "Hak minish kumchanik," and the kids would say, "Well, what does that mean?" She'd say, "Don't chop me a tea kettle."
Right.
And he'd be totally confused. And then a caller notices that Yiddish insults and curses are very elaborate. Is that something unique to Yiddish or European culture? For example, they say there's a saying, "May all your teeth fall out but one," or one that I remember, "You should be buried with your head down and your feet up like an onion."
Right. Right, the toothache curse is you should lose all your teeth except for one so you can have a toothache.
But are these did these go back a long time?
It's not really clear. I think that they do because they're part of, you know, the oral history of this language, and you know they're part of, you know, the wealth of cultural riches that exist in it. You know, it ethnographers first started writing these down in the beginning of the 20th century, so it's not really clear how long they existed prior to that.
And what about things like Hak Minash Nish
Kinchinik?
It's very metaphorical. There are an awful lot of idioms like that that are a lot more complex than English idioms that don't make much sense.
Sure.
One of the things that Ivo commissioned in the early days in Poland was to collect obscenities and sayings in the marketplace, because you have to remember there was no dictionary of Yiddish until the middle of the 20th century. And a friend of mine, who was a young boy in Vilna at the time, was commissioned by Max Weinreich, who was then head of the Ivo Institute, to go into the marketplace and collect obscenities from the local women who were at the various stalls selling onions and apples and so forth. And so he would torment a particular woman until she would yell at him, and he would write that down. And he brought it to Weinreich, and Weinreich said, "That's not good enough. Go back." And he would continue to torment her until finally he stole something, and she yelled at him, "May your intestines turn into a telephone wire."
Oh, gee. Bonnie from the Lower East Side, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yes, I have a question. Just a moment. Yeah, I just had to fix my phone there. Yeah, this is a question about a particular word I have always loved. It's my favorite Yiddish word. My grandmother used to use it. It's ungepatschkin. Now, I know what it means. My mother told me that it means busy. You know, my grandmother would buy a dress, and she'd say, "So, you like it, or you think it's too ungepatschkin?" But what I'm wondering is, it sounds like it might be some sort of compound word. Like, I know in German, unge, if you put unge in front of something, it makes it negative. Like, ungerecht means unjust. So is there such a word as patschkid, and does ungepatschkid mean not patschkid?
It's on. Is in this case, it's not negative. But patschkin, in this case, unpatschkin, which is a verb, means to sort of, you know, hastily put together, you know, in a sort of messy way.
Yeah, well, you might also say the book was ungepatschkin because there's just so many different things going on at
right.
the same time. Just one more thing, because we are running out of time. In May, Arvind V. Manhankali of Bayside, Queens, won the Scripps National Spelling Bee by correctly spelling the Yiddish word knadel. You want to talk about the controversy? He spelt it in a way that I wouldn't have won the spelling bee with, because I would have spelt it differently.
But how would you have spelled it?
Either K-N-O-E-D-L or E-L or O-E is, well, anyway.
Because you have two main pronunciations of the word. You have knadel and knidel.
Yeah. Well, that's the Galiciana version.
Right. Well, and in linguistics, these areas are divided by what's known as the gefilte fish line. And the gefilte fish line is a line that runs almost north-south between the Jewish idea of Lithuania, which does not correspond to the country of Lithuania, but actually comprises a much larger area, and Poland. And the pronunciation on to the west of the line is knadel, and to the east of the line is knadel. And actually, to refer to the standardization issue, the standardizers mostly came from the east of the line.
And there are different ways of spelling all sorts of foreign words, as we see when people write Arabic words or Russian words. because they're written in different alphabets. The same thing happens with Yiddish, I assume.
Sure, right, of course. I mean, you really rely on the Hebrew alphabet to standardize it, and whatever happens in English.
I guess I hope we haven't driven our audience too meshuggah with this conversation. But my great thanks to both of you for participating. It's been a lot of fun. Eddie Portnoy is the academic advisor at EVO Institute for Jewish Research, and Jonathan Brent is the executive director at EVO Institute for Jewish Research. You have both been just wonderful, and thank you to all of you who have called in and written in.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.